Let's welcome again to Nick Hudson. He's the coordinator of what is called PANDA, very well known now, Pandemics, Data and Analysis. Catchy name, Nick, but an even more catchy issue is the open letter that you've written to Professor Juliet Pulliam from SAKIMA. What exactly is SAKIMA?
They're one of the many groups that are advising our government and building models that the government uses to estimate the future disease burden of COVID-19 in the country, to try and work out how many hospital beds and ventilators and so on are needed.
And they came up with a number, which has been widely quoted now, of 40,000. It seemed to be lower than the initial estimates of the mortalities in South Africa.
Slightly lower, yes, about a tenth.
Seriously? Were some people believing that we'd have 400,000 deaths in South Africa?
It was around 375,000, if I remember correctly, Alec. And I think this is what scared the living daylights out of our state president. And when he saw forecasts that entailed, you know, 2.5 million shortage of hospital beds, I think that's what caused us to enter into the state of disaster and eventually the lockdown. And of course, over time, those models have been significantly reduced to this current 40,000 level, which we still believe is a drastic overestimate. Now, our view is that the actual format of these models, the structure of these models is wrong and has been proven to be wrong every day for months now. This model class should not be used at all. And we've said that. We were involved in the Minister Mkhize's modeling symposium 2 weeks ago. After all the modelers presented, we made our case for why these models are wrong. We wrote an article that you very kindly promoted on your website, and that has been very widely read, pointing out very specific problems with the models. And to date, we've had no engagement from any of the parties involved answering to these questions that we've raised, which is, in our mind, an admission of guilt. They know. They know that their models are not appropriate.
Nick, just go back a little. How did they come to a figure of 375,000?
The way these models work, Alec, is that you build a very complicated exponentiating state model, which is something that it kind of treats people as random variables, and you go from a state of susceptible, exposed, infected, and then either recovering or dying. So they're very complicated models that have to be calibrated in some way. You need to make assumptions, and those assumptions then get built on in a very highly exponentiated way. Now, what an exponentiated growth involves is that each day you get a constant percentage more of cases or deaths or whatever the case may be. And that results in, it's like compound growth in money, you know, compounding of interest. That results in very rapid escalation of the number of cases and deaths and so on. Now, that simply has not been observed anywhere in the world. You know, normally the exponentiating phase, if there really is one at all, is very short, and then the growth rate of cases starts dropping off. And this is not something that's just been observed recently. This was observed as early as February. In no country in the world have we had this kind of continuous exponentiation. That's the first problem. The second problem, they make an assumption about the number of people who are susceptible to dangerous infection. And the typical assumption being made, as far as we can tell, is that 100% of people are susceptible. But in the wild, in the real world, the actual story is much lighter. You have 10%, maybe 20%, as high as 25%. But that makes an awful difference. If most people in a population are able to what we call bounce the disease, in other words, they just don't get affected by it. If they get exposed, they get their bodies deal with the infection very easily. If most people are in that category, then they'll never test positive after exposure. They won't have positive antibody tests or positive virology tests. And if you have 30, 50, 80% of your population in that category, it makes a big difference. And we think the numbers are large like that. We've got every single population in the world contains a lot of people who are simply resistant to being infected. And that is a robust finding. It's very hard. You won't find a single data point refuting that. And yet the models continue to use these very high susceptibility rates.
So let's just go back. The very first assumption here, as you say, was around 400,000. That's now been brought down to 40,000. It sounds a bit like in the UK, where they had a 550,000 projection from the Imperial College, which was brought down to now, well, significantly lower than that. But you believe that the 40,000 is still too high. Why? And what is your number?
Yeah, the 40,000 would make South Africa one of the worst affected nations in the world. When you look at... Okay, so the first thing to understand here is that you're dealing with a disease that has a very strong age-related effect. So in countries like in Western Europe, where you have a lot of old people, Italy, Spain, Belgium, you know, the death rates as a percentage of population are higher than in countries that have younger populations like ours. So that's the first very important feature that should be observed, is with the younger population, we expect to have fewer deaths per million. Okay.
Is that not being observed in that 40,000?
No, we don't believe so. That's the first thing that's not been observed. The second thing that's not being observed is when you look at the international experience, developing countries have much lighter experience than developed countries. And we noticed this early on, straight after Italy, hot on the tail of Italy, was you saw Iran starting to erupt with cases. And very quickly, within a few days, it became clear that the situation there wasn't going to escalate to nearly the levels that Italy attained. And if I'm not mistaken, it ended up capping out at about 1/8 the level of deaths per unit of population. We started noticing that and then paying attention as all the epidemics broke out around the developing world. And what's observed time and time and time again is that in developing countries, there's simply much lighter experience. The way we model this is if we went along on the basis of just the age structure of South Africa relative to the worst affected countries in the world. So if we took Belgium as our starting point, and then we factored in the age adjustment for South Africa, we come up with roughly 18,000 deaths as our expectation. So already, just using that adjustment, half the level that these other modelers have mysteriously all arrived at, okay? And then we take something off that to reflect the fact that we're similar to Mexico or Russia or the Eastern European countries, that we have a developing nation on our hands. And that brings us down to the range of saying, well, not more than 10,000 and possibly a good deal less. It's very simple logic. We're not getting involved in solving complex systems of differential equations or pontificating about the number of hospital beds that are going to be needed on Sunday the 23rd or the color of the grasshopper's nose next door. You know, it's just we're taking a very simple, pragmatic view, comparing it to other countries and saying, is there any reason to believe that South Africa will behave any differently? We do run a few tests to test whether there is anything unique about South Africa's experience. People were worried about HIV. People were worried about TB. Those were not silly things to be worried about. But there's simple tests you can perform just to see if our epidemic is evolving in a way that's out of the parameters that would be observed from the experience in New York or Belgium. And we just simply do not see them. We see an epidemic that in terms of the age of people who are affected and the comorbidities of the people that are affected, it behaves very similarly to what has been observed elsewhere.
Anybody who's ever looked at the investment scenario will know that it depends on the assumptions that you're putting into your model to what comes out at the end. And clearly what you are attacking here are the assumptions, and you've made your case quite strongly for your assumptions. But if you have a look at where we are at the moment, we've had 5 days roughly of a similar level of new infections in South Africa. Is this telling us something yet?
It's a huge mistake to focus on cases. Most of the infections out there in the wild are never going to be detected. So what you're measuring is not new infections, as you just described it, but new detections. And you could go and measure anywhere in the country right now. You will pick up a certain percentage, don't know what it is, but a certain percentage of people who are infected. There could well be hundreds of thousands, maybe more than a million cases out there. And most of them will just be getting on with their lives. They don't even know that they are infected with the virus. They might develop antibodies. They might not. You know, it's such a mild infection. For almost all the people, this will be the case. And so this business of trying to chase after the one infection who arrives at the hospital complaining of a cough and runny nose and a headache or whatever, chasing the contacts of that person and trying to catch and prevent the transmission is really ludicrous. There's no scientific basis for doing any of that. It was wishful thinking in the beginning, and once the population exposure has set into reasonable levels, which it clearly has at this point in South Africa, it becomes just farcical. It beggars belief that we even pursue such a lark.
So we should be looking at the mortalities, presumably.
That's the thing to look at, and you need to look at that and follow that very carefully. I mean, so far this disease is behaving just like it has in other countries. The sub-exponentiating growth in the number of deaths. Our belief is that there's no reason to expect things to evolve differently in South Africa from any other country. And you look at that, how have they evolved? Well, you get to the peak death situation quite quickly, within a couple of months at the most. So we're looking at this and saying, sometime this month we'll hit our peak deaths. And that's another way in which our very simple, logical kind of way of looking at this in light of international experience differs from the models. These guys have got these highly evolved exponentiating models that predict peaks in September, November, far away. And there isn't a single country in the world that's exhibited that kind of pattern. Again, it's this breathtaking failure to take a look. Once you've done all your assuming and your complicated Excel spreadsheets and Python coding and all this kind of stuff, and they've built this elaborate mousetrap, you know, don't you take a step back and compare the results to the rest of the world? I mean, a very simple thing we've been asking people to do is, okay, well, forget about South Africa. Let's go and look at a country that's already been through its peak. Let's go and look at Italy. Recalibrate your model for Italy or for Spain, okay, and check whether it produces a result that bears some faint resemblance to what actually happened in that country, you know? So take your infection fatality rates, take your susceptibility percentages, take the population structure of Italy and see whether your model works. And the answer is that they haven't done this. They can't have. If they had done that, they'd be modifying their models.
And they're not.
I think they wouldn't even be using their models, because those models, I think, are structurally unable to work for this disease.
So when will you be able to prove your point? Presumably there will be a time that you'll be able to say South Africa is not going to replicate the worst in the world.
Our point has already been proven. Our point is proven every day. When models of this nature simply fail to produce the goods elsewhere in the world. I think if you want to take a very strong line, you can say, when is our point going to be proven in South Africa? Well, you know, any day now. But the stunning thing here is that the forecasts and features of these models, you know, have been loudly spoken about. When people lift their lockdowns, as Denmark did more than a month ago, you know, the forecast that these modelers have is that there's going to be this massive resurgence of deaths. Then the resurgence doesn't happen. And nobody says, oh, our model must be wrong, let's reconsider. They just disappear, stay silent. And so this is what I mean when I say day after day, these models are being proven incorrect. And so, you know, our model doesn't need to be proven in the sense that it's consistent with all the observable experience. It'll be falsified the day some country comes out and does something different, okay? And then we'll be surprised, and then we'll have to revise our model. That's what we would do, is if we found some fact that contradicted our model, we would immediately reconsider and try and understand, try and create an explanation for what was causing a change, you know? And that's what these guys are failing to do. It's a very profound failing in the scientific method itself. They create a hypothesis. When the real world data comes along and contradicts the hypothesis, the thing to do is to revise the hypothesis. And they are simply not doing this. It's staggering. It's pseudoscience.
There is a view that what's happening in the Western Cape right now will be reflected in other provinces around the country. Does that align itself with your analysis?
Yes. It's, you know, what's happening in the Western Cape is not completely out of line at all. It's, as we say, this sub-exponentiating growth. The growth rate is declining every couple of days. You know, you can see it. You have to smooth it out because obviously there's small numbers of deaths involved, and so the from day to day, there's quite a little bit of fluctuation and volatility, and it's hard to pin a rate onto any particular day's events. But it's exactly what we expect, exactly what the modelers don't expect, this sub-exponentiating growth. And so we would expect that very soon there would be a peaking within a week or two. You'd get a peak daily deaths for the Western Cape, and then it would begin to decline. And yes, I agree with you. It looks as if the other provinces are a little bit behind. And look, in principle, there's no reason why you can't take a subset of a country or even a subset of a province and model for that group alone. But it does start to get a little bit spurious. We don't have certainty. We don't have the ability to predict what's going to happen in a particular house or a particular suburb or something like that. You need to aggregate at some level. Our view here is there's nothing to suggest that anything unusual is happening in South Africa. The Western Cape's a little bit earlier, possibly will end up being a little bit worse, and it'll be interesting to try and analyze why. And then what will follow is something in the Eastern Cape, something in Gauteng. But again, nothing that's looking anywhere near as dramatic as what was originally forecast. Just a reminder, we are talking about something that's 30 to 50 times smaller than what scared the president into action. It's a huge departure from the starting point.
At a massive cost.
At an unbelievable cost. At an unbelievable cost. I mean, you know, when we wrote that original paper on the years of life lost to lockdown, we were still entertaining that there could be some benefit from the lockdown in terms of avoiding overcapacitation of the hospital system or something like that. We've subsequently done a lot of work looking at what the effect of lockdowns were overseas. And the answers are, you know, quite surprising and a little bit, you know, stomach turning, a little bit surprising. There appears to be no effect. These lockdowns don't have a curve flattening effect. If you measure across all the countries in the world how long it takes for them to go from their first death to their peak death, in other words, the top of the curve that you're trying to flatten, and you compare that duration to the severity of the lockdown or the impact of the lockdown, which you can measure using cell phone mobility data, the answer is that there's no relationship between the severity of the lockdown or the impact of the lockdown and the duration to the peak of the curve. It's a very strong finding, and it's being replicated all over the world. Lots of researchers are finding exactly the same result. So this, and I just want to pause with that. You know, it's such an important finding that the amount and stringency of lockdown, the impact of lockdown, neither are relevant in terms of flattening the curve. There's no curve flattening that's gone on anywhere in the world. And that comes as a big surprise to people to hear that, because I think what people perceive is they think of the original forecast in South Africa, the 375,000 forecast. Then there was a lockdown and we didn't get 375,000 deaths. And the conclusion is, oh, look, the lockdown. Okay. That's wrong. The correct conclusion is that the original model was wrong. We know why it's wrong. We know which assumptions were wrong. We know what structural problems with the model are at fault. Okay. So that number should just be forgotten about. It was the dreams of crazy people, okay? What's emerged with the disease is no different from what's emerged in countries that have lockdowns and countries that don't have lockdowns. Whether you're in Sweden or Belarus or New York or whatever, our pattern is very similar. So it seems pretty clear to us as we do more and more research on this subject, and it's research which we will publish soon, again in the form of a working paper so that people can get an early look rather than a later look. It seems that lockdown has had no impact.
And the assumptions that are being used by Sakima, in other words, the people that government is listening to, this 40,000 mortalities that they're talking about, what are those assumptions? How are they different to yours?
We've written to them, we've written to them asking them to reveal those assumptions. We think it's time to have a little bit of an answer session here, you know. After all, the country's incurred enormous costs as a result of listening to these modelers. And it's not just South African models, it's models all around the world. And the country's incurred enormous costs. It's time to answer. We need to have a look. We have a pretty clear idea. We can back solve, you know, we can build a simple model that where we can work out what they must have been assuming. And I think we have a pretty accurate read on that. But we'd rather hear it from them. What did you guys assume when you were coming up with 375,000 and why? And what are you assuming now that you're coming up with 40,000 and why? And why haven't you answered the questions which we've asked in the article on the BizNews and in the forum with the Models Symposium with Minister Mkhize? Why haven't those questions been asked? You know, if you know very well that people are suffering, that people are being plunged into poverty as a result of your models, you know very well that key questions, very hard questions, have been asked of those models and you haven't answered them. It's an inexcusable situation to be in. These people have blood on their hands, Alec.